The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com. Just between us. Hey.
Just between us. Hey. Hello, I'm Allison Raskin. I'm a writer, mental health advocate, and I have sneezed more today than I sneeze on most days.
Hi, I'm Gabe Dunn. I'm a writer, bi-con, bisexual icon, wink and vogue, vogue. Let your body move to the music.
Beautiful.
That's it.
How do you know when you're sneezing because it's an allergy versus you're sneezing because you have a cold?
Sinus pressure. Allergies, I think for me, it's like a little like a little sneeze. And then like sick is like, I'm holding my face like the alien from Alien going into that guy's face. It's like it's like congestion, and there's like there's a real heft to it.
That's a great answer. Thank you.
You're welcome. I'm a doctor.
Well, this is Just Between Us, a variety show filled with heartfelt advice,
ridiculous games,
and brutal honesty.
I told you one time I had a doctor Google my symptoms in front of me.
Yeah.
What the hell, man?
Also, I feel like a big thing about a lot of times when these doctors like solve this thing that like nobody could figure out, it's because of like recency bias, and they have just been like reading about that issue. You know?
You think?
Sometimes, probably.
The list of things that we don't like on this show is like, one, doctors. Two, the French. Three. You know what I mean? Like, our list of enemies is unhinged. Three, child vloggers. Four, family vloggers that exploit their children. Four, who else do I not like? Ticket scalpers, hate them.
Oh, yeah.
Or not scalpers, people that are selling fake concert tickets. Those are evil. That person's evil.
I don't know if they have a lot of people out there defending them, though. I think that's a pretty...
Who's defending the French?
The French? Probably everyone who lives in France.
Nah.
I have been so tempted to send you guys TikToks of like people being like, yeah, I live in France and everyone is mean to me.
This is so funny coming from a New Yorker.
New Yorkers are nice.
When?
New Yorkers, like, if you're lost, like, a New Yorker will, like, come and help you.
Okay.
Like, they're maybe not, like,
they're brusque,
polite.
But they're not
They're
mean.
Brusque, but they're not mean.
Yeah.
Like, when I was in France, we, like, could not figure out how to open the subway door, and everyone just looked at us.
Oh, my God.
Again, this was a long time ago. John says we have to go back, and I have to give it another try.
Longtime fans will know of your hatred of France. I just had a situation with a longtime fan, the person who edits, Emma, who edits clips for us from our Thursday couch shows, our youtube.com/justbetweenus. And we mentioned one of my exes. And then this person who edits was like, oh, is it the ex that you referenced in literally a video from 100 years ago? A video that was dug out from the ground as a fossil. Okay. And she was like, oh, is it from the same person from this? And I was like, what the what?
I don't remember almost all of our content. Sketches will pop up and I'll be like, what? That's funny. That's a good idea.
Oh my God. That's like George Lucas was like, I wrote Star Wars years ago. You just saw it yesterday. You know what I mean?
That's so true.
I don't remember what I said, but then people that are fans, like the girl that is working as my assistant, when she came and presented me her presentation on how to be my assistant, she had like remember she was like, so I listened to things, shout out to Ariel, she was like, I listened to these episodes with you. And it seems like you prefer your workflow to be like she had studied me. I know. That's it wild. Was the most flattering thing ever. I loved it. I have no self-preservation. I was like, this person who, like, yes, please understand me.
I just want to say on record that I don't believe that any, like, I don't like to make broad statements about any big group of people or country, but it is an ongoing joke that I hate France.
Yeah. France can take it.
Okay. Well, we've got a really fun episode for everyone today. Informative, fascinating. I loved it.
We have an interview with Brad Gooch all about Keith Haring and art and the art movement in New York in the late 70s and 80s. I am so excited. It was such a good conversation. I was thrilled when he wanted to come on the show. It's everything I've ever wanted and hoped for. It's gay as fuck.
And later we'll be talking about celebrity interviews because there's been a string of interesting encounters, to say the least.
Allison's BFF, Dakota Johnson.
Just really fascinating stuff.
Up next, we've got an exciting interview with our highly esteemed guest, Brad Gooch. So stay tuned. Just
Between Us. Welcome back to Just Between Us. It's time for the juiciest, most scandalous, most controversial segment known to all of podcasting. Tough questions.
This week on the show, we have Brad Gooch, a poet, novelist, biographer, whose previous 10 books include Flannery, A Life of Flannery O'Connor, and a bunch of other books. But we are actually here to talk about Keith Haring, which I am super excited to talk about. Thank you for joining us.
Glad to be with a Keith Haring fan, or two Keith Haring fans.
I don't know much, I'll admit it, but Gabe was ecstatic at the idea of getting to talk to you. So.
I was absolutely thrilled when you got pitched to us because I have just come off of going to the Keith Haring exhibit in LA and then also to Luna Luna, which was incredible. And Luna Luna, for those listening, is an art theme park that was made in Germany in the 80s. And they had all these different artists, Basquiat, a bunch of different people, and they took it down. And then it was like in a shipping container for, I don't know, decades. And then they finally put it together and it's for display in Los Angeles. You can go see it. And it was so beautiful and so incredible. But a big part of the Keith Haring exhibit was kind of this dichotomy between his more popular works and then the works that like don't get as much publicity. So I do want to talk about that, but can we start with like who he was and like where he sort of sprang out of?
Incidentally, I spoke at the Broad and then I went to the Luna Luna with Basquiat's sister and Wilkie Jones, name dropping. And it was earlier. So it was still, you know, some of it was built and the Keith stuff was built, but those containers were there that you're talking about. I mean, that had, it was like a huge, you know, sort of Lego kind of thing with no directions. I mean, they didn't know how to put things together. There were no instructions and they had to figure it out and it hadn't been done in decades. So that was fantastic in itself. And I'm going to be there, I think, on March 20th back. So I'll see the way it is now, wow, what you saw. But Keith Haring, came from Kutztown, Pennsylvania, a small conservative town. That doesn't sound that promising for an artist, but was. Had a Marine father who was also a cartoonist, and this has had like big influence on him. So his father from age 4 was getting him to draw original cartoons and showing him Walt Disney and Dr. Seuss. From there he went, goes a little bit to Pittsburgh. When he was in fourth grade, he wrote a little essay that said, "When I grow up, I want to be an artist. I want to live in Paris, France. I will sell my drawings and live that way, hopefully." So that was his vision. Pittsburgh wasn't exactly it, but his parents, it was a compromise with his parents who didn't see art as a career path, especially at that time. Keith was born in 1958. So he was in a school there, and then he comes to New York in 1978, and that's where he wanted to be, and that's kind of where it all happens for him. So he sort of hits the streets immediately in New York City. Goes to a real art school for a couple of years, School of Visual Arts. And, you know, at that time, New York was very lively, and Keith was living in the East Village. I was living in the East Village at that time. And, you know, everything, I mean, it was very dark. The street lamps were always like half lit, amber kind of things. But there were all these messages being sent. I mean, there were plastered on walls were posters for rock concerts or like Talking Heads at CBGB's or political posters. Jean-Michel Basquiat was doing street art of crowns and shadows. And so Keith really wanted to be part of this and this chat. You know, we didn't have social media then, but we had the streets, and you either had to go to the clubs or to the streets to meet someone and to communicate. So he wanted to be part of this, and that, but it took him then about 2 years to figure out his language and his sort of platform, which becomes the subways. And he starts doing chalk drawings on the subways, eventually 5,000 of them over 5 years. And so this is all free art, art for the people, you know, which was a big concept for Keith Haring. And that's how Keith Haring became Keith Haring, or began to become.
For those of people listening who aren't the super fans that you and I are, what would they recognize of Keith Haring? Like, who is he that they would go, oh, that guy?
Yeah, it is interesting because people always recognize kind of the work of Keith Haring, not necessarily the name. So when I say he was trying to figure out his way in, at some point he starts drawing original cartoons in a way, the barking dog, the crawling baby, the exploding bombs, the flying saucers. And this all becomes the language of Keith Haring. And these figures, people recognize these colorful figures jumping around, and especially the crawling baby, which became his kind of signature. And it had all these kind of radiating lines. So that becomes his language. And now people do recognize it because through the miracle of licensing, you have a lot of Keith Haring on everybody's sweatshirts and hoodies and everywhere. And this is what, debatable as it has always been within the art world, has always been part of Keith's mission in a way, that you have art, that t-shirts are prints, and that art should be available to everyone at every price point. So Keith was doing fine art that's in museums, and he was doing pins and babies and chalk drawings on subways. So people usually recognize those exuberant little kind of dynamic, optimistic, colorful Keith Haring drawings, I think.
We're going to take a quick break, but stick around.
With Mother's Day around the corner, are you thinking about a truly special gift for your mom? Let me tell you all about MyLifeInABook.com. It's a unique service that turns your mom's life stories into a beautiful book. Pretty cool, right? Here's how it works. Every week, MyLifeInABook.com will send her a question via email. These can be pre-written questions about her life or any custom questions you wish to ask. And then she can either type her response or use their voice-to-text feature. And MyLifeInABook.com compiles all her responses into a beautiful keepsake book. And guess what? They can even create an audiobook using her voice recordings. It's like preserving her voice and her stories for eternity. Imagine discovering stories about her youth, adventures, and the challenges she overcame. This book becomes a legacy, something you and future generations can treasure forever. Your mom's given you a lifetime of stories. This is your chance to give her a way to share them. Right before I found out about this project, my mom made an offhand comment about wanting to write a memoir because she had such a wild childhood and there are all these things she's never really talked to us about. But asking someone to sit down and write a memoir is kind of daunting. So then I got her mylifeinabook.com, and now she's getting prompts to answer on a weekly basis, and it's a lot easier than just undertaking an entire memoir. I'm so excited to see what my mom does with mylifeinabook.com because she's someone who doesn't always feel comfortable just sharing about herself, but having these prompts and knowing that I really want to hear her answers is going to inspire her to probably share more with me about her life and her upbringing than I've ever been shared with before. So I'm so excited for that. Check out mylifeinabook.com and use code JUSTBETWEENUS at checkout for 10% off. Create an unforgettable gift for your mom this Mother's Day. That's mylifeinabook.com. Use code JUSTBETWEENUS for 10% off today.
Has dealing with stress and trying to get more focused a New Year's resolution you haven't cracked yet or don't really know how to fix? I have a lot of trouble staying focused, and I also get super stressed out, and I think the not being able to stay focused really dovetails with that. So if there was a way for me to keep my focus that didn't also cause my brain to get so scattered with stress, I would love to be able to fix it. I sometimes can't focus on the task at hand because I'm so busy realizing that there are things I need to do on the Just Between Us Instagram account. So I'll be like fully writing something and all of a sudden my brain will go, JBU Instagram, have to post on social media. Truvaga is a handheld product that stimulates the vagus nerve to improve overall health and wellness. Stimulating the vagus nerve with Truvaga helps to balance and strengthen the nervous system, which reduces stress, increases focus, improves mood, and improves sleep. Truvaga is owned by ElectroCore and uses its patented technology for overall health and wellness benefits. Its utilized technology is the most clinically studied and tested vagus nerve therapy available. Customizable sessions are only 2 minutes long. Recommended usage is one session in the morning and one at night. Truvaga comes programmed with 350 sessions, which, if used twice a day, will last approximately 6 months. It's drug-free and easy-to-use therapy to help improve your health. No app or phone is required. We offer free standard shipping, payment plan options, and a 30-day money-back guarantee. It's only available in the U.S. at this time. Visit Truvaga.com, TRUVAGA.com, and enter promo code JUSTBETWEENUS to enhance your wellness journey, support this podcast, and receive $15 off. That's TRUVAGA.com. Check out promo code JUSTBETWEENUS.
Hi, everyone. Allison here. Anyone who knows me well knows that I love to read. I am always looking for new books, and that is why I am so excited that this episode is sponsored by Book of the Month. Book of the Month's mission is to help readers discover new books they love and to promote the work of emerging authors. It was so fun for me to get to pick which book I wanted to read this month and have it shipped right to my door. Book of the Month makes it easy to decide which book to read next. Each month, the editorial team reads through hundreds of new titles. They pick some of the best new books for you to choose from. All the books are good, so you can't go wrong. Every aspect of the Book of the Month experience is designed to be fun and special for readers. They have a highly anticipated release at the beginning of each month. Books are delivered in this really adorable bright blue box, and there's a fun app to help you pick your book and track your reading process. They also offer great values on new release hardcover fiction. It's much cheaper than other options, shipping is always free, and with a loyalty program, you get rewards and even lower prices the longer you stay as a member. My first book from Book of the Month was The Husbands by Holly Gramazio. I am tearing through this book. It is so fun. It's basically about this woman who one day comes home and there's a husband in her apartment, and she's like, "Where did you come from?" And then she figures out that every time her new husband goes into the attic, a new husband comes out, and she's like shuffling through all these different husbands from the attic trying to figure out which one is the best. It is right up my alley, and I love it so much. So if you want to take part in Book of the Month and have a brand new book shipped right to your door every single month, go to bookofthemonth.com and get your first book for $5 with code PETALS. That's $5 off with code PETALS. I cannot recommend this enough.
Just between us. And we're back.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's something that's so fascinating about the art world is like when people get crowned as successful or crowned as talented. And, you know, like, why do you think he made that jump from like kind of street art to like being respected and being able to also show in museums?
Yeah, it's interesting. He made a kind of runaround, I guess you would call it. I mean, he was very inspired by subway art at that moment, like 1978 in New York City. Was a high point, a very good year for wild style graffiti, which are these big, colorful, like acid colored paintings on subways, right? Big bubble lettering. So he really loved the access of that to everyone. And so his version then was when he found these blank advertising panels that were there between the time he put up an ad and then ripped one down and started drawing his figures and his babies and his barking dogs on these black spaces that no one had ever really noticed before. And suddenly you have, you know, there are millions of people take the subways every day. And not all of them are staring at the drawings, but enough that he has an audience then. So he doesn't go around to gallery dealers and show his slides and try to find a dealer. He just starts and gets an audience, and it's an audience that hasn't been there for art before. So he does get a dealer named Tony Shafrazi, and his first show brings in this other kind of audience. I mean, he had his boyfriend Juan DuBose was the DJ, and it was just people who hadn't been necessarily in art galleries, and it was covered on the CBS Evening News with Dan Rather. So that's unusual for a first show by a 24-year-old artist. So he, from the beginning, had this kind of, was a scene maker and had a lot of energy, and, you know, at the same time was serious about his art and starts showing in galleries. There's still a lot of controversy in America, especially with the commercial side of him and the giveaway side of him, that it's not really fine art. But in Europe, as has happened to other artists, poets from America before, he really gets taken up. And he's shown in museums in the south of France, in Paris, in Amsterdam. I mean, the, kind of the most important galleries and museums and most respected at the time. So he has a kind of two-track career going on. And that's still true today. He's also influenced another generation. I think part of why we're talking about Keith Haring now is you have this kind of unforced way in which we have artists like Banksy, Kaws, Shepard Fairey, who are also very interested in doing public art and in activism. And Keith was a political activist, or an artivist, as they called him at the time. And, you know, this all seems understandable to us now. At the time, it was kind of him. I mean, and a few others. It was more unusual.
I was going to ask about the importance of finding the art community, because he goes to New York and then he has these contemporaries, these peers that he's working with. A lot of them are shown in Luna Luna, but like, how important was it to have that scene and that group? And like, how did they all sort of, like, who was in it and how were they all sort of like working together?
Yeah, that was important to Keith. And part of what it sometimes made him unusual as an artist is that he was also interested in the art of his friends and in building community. I mean, he'd been that as a kid. He had a little clubhouse in Kutztown, Pennsylvania, and a Monkees fan club. And it sort of carries over then. So a bunch of students at School of Visual Arts start hanging out at this club called Club 57 in the basement of a Polish church on St. Mark's Place in the East Village. And this is, you know, always seemed to me like a kind of silly club, but you know, there's a lot of tripping on mushrooms there, and a lot of playing Twister and watching monster movies and that kind of like hijinks kids sort of fun. And he's joined there by Kenny Sharp, who's his kind of best art buddy at SVA. Jean-Michel Basquiat, who's not actually going to school there, but who's in and out and very much a part of that life, and Magnuson, other kind of artists. Their hero is Andy Warhol, and they loved the 60s scene that Andy had at the factory when he was making those kind of movies and with Candy Darling and things. And so they were trying to, you know, in part they were seeing themselves as recreating that, so they had that kind of mission, and they were also just having a lot of fun, and there were very few sexual boundaries, and every night was a party. But Keith had started curating shows there, and so that they would be like shows of anonymous art, or just completely open shows, where anyone who wanted to show could put something up, or Xerox shows. And I guess his most successful was an erotic show, and because Anne Magnuson, who lives in L.A., was kind of performance artist, and she told me about, she had brought the bishop from the Polish church upstairs and come down to see the art exhibit, and she had to like steer him away from a giant silver phallus that was on the opposite wall, kind of show him out. So that's what, you know, that's where we're going. And amazingly, those artists are pretty important. I mean, that scene is very much what we now associate, I think, with the 1980s, and certainly, and Basquiat and Haring and Sharp have endured in a way. And I think part of it was that again, they got beyond the sense of the genius artist in their garret, you know, creating these kinds of works and just for galleries and museums. I remember someone described Diego Cortez, who was someone on the scene at the time and kind of curator. And he said the galleries before then were like white boxes with white people drinking white wine. And it was in this kind of minimal art. And it was, so it was like that. And then you got these, this young generation that came along was doing the opposite and doing things spontaneously and making color works and creating installations and big, big messes at times. It put people in a creative and good mood. So I think that was part of the energy, right? That's propelled us here.
How do you like explain his philosophy of art for the people? Like, can you trace back like what led him to think that way?
Yeah, it's interesting. I mean, it was his, I guess in certain ways, temperament. I mean, Keith was a generous guy and was interested in community. And he, you know, through subway art as a white kid, was also hooked up with black and brown and artists of color doing street art who weren't in galleries yet at that point. He was very open to kids in terms of inclusivity. So when he had that show that I was talking about that was on the news, not only did he have the DJ in the basement, he had done coloring books for kids, and he had kids at the show too. So it was this kind of just temperamental inclusivity and looking for community that he had, and also, you know, and a distrust and dislike of the way the art world was structured. I mean, he took one class at SVA in semiotics, and part of what they were talking about was the value of, you know, the less there is of a certain artist, the more valuable it becomes. And so ideas like that, like don't make too much art because then it'll be too easy to buy and just do a few. So it was an elitist approach. And he was kind of temperamentally against that. And he had also been influenced by what you would think of as popular art. I mean, he grew up, he loved television. He loved color television and cartoons. He was influenced by Walt Disney, as I said. And, you know, at a certain point, he was a Jesus freak. And at a certain point, he was a Grateful Dead head. And so he had, you know, there was something very popular about him, just viscerally. So he kind of didn't fit in to the way things were.
So, wow. First of all, the fact that you were around in New York at that time makes me so jealous.
You should be. You know, except for the getting mugged and the...
Sure.
We're going to take a quick break, but stick around.
The future is a hefty responsibility and not one that we take lightly. But then taking things lightly has never been what Hefty is about. That's why we've created the Hefty Renew program that turns hard to recycle plastics into valuable resources like park benches and building materials. To participate, simply fill up an orange Hefty Renew bag with accepted items, tie it up, and drop it in with your regular recycling. That's it. It's that easy. It's time to rethink recycling with Renew. Particular valued resources may vary by geography. More info available at heftyrenew.com.
Has dealing with stress and trying to get more focused a New Year's resolution you haven't cracked yet or don't really know how to fix? I have a lot of trouble staying focused, and I also get super stressed out, and I think that not being able to stay focused really dovetails with that. So if there was a way for me to keep my focus that didn't also cause my brain to get so scattered with stress, I would love to be able to fix it. I sometimes can't focus on the task at hand because I'm so busy realizing that there are things I need to do on the Just Between Us Instagram account. So I'll be like fully writing something and all of a sudden my brain will go, JBU Instagram, have to post on social media. Truvaga is a handheld product that stimulates the vagus nerve to improve overall health and wellness. Stimulating the vagus nerve with Truvaga helps to balance and strengthen the nervous system, which reduces stress, increases focus, improves mood, and improves sleep. Truvaga is owned by ElectroCore and uses its patented technology for overall health and wellness benefits. Its utilized technology is the most clinically studied and tested vagus nerve therapy available. Customizable sessions are only 2 minutes long. Recommended usage is one session in the morning and one at night. Truvaga comes programmed with 350 sessions, which, if used twice a day, will last approximately 6 months. It's drug-free and easy-to-use therapy to help improve your health. No app or phone is required. We offer free standard shipping, payment plan options, and a 30-day money-back guarantee. It's only available in the U.S. at this time. Visit Truvaga.com, Truvaga.com, and enter promo code JUSTBETWEENUS to enhance your wellness journey, support this podcast, and receive $15 off. That's Truvaga.com. Check out promo code JUSTBETWEENUS. And we're back. How did the queerness affect everything? How did, you know, I think going to New York was sort of always like a queer dream for a lot of us.
Yeah.
So like, how did that play into, and like, I think a lot of the artists that you were discussing that he had around him were also queer.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Yeah. Good part of that. And certainly, I mean, Keith came to New York City to become an artist, but he, you know, he also came, like most of us, to you know, to be gay and to find other people. I mean, we're all coming from, I'm from a town in Pennsylvania, Wilkes-Barre, Pennsylvania. So, you know, at that time, you couldn't, everything was still pretty repressed. And New York was one of the, if you can, you needed to come to a big city to meet people. You couldn't go online. And Keith comes, and then within, I mean, 24 hours, the boy finds his way to Christopher Street. And Christopher Street in 1978 was a big parade. You know, it was the year YMCA was written. And so it was that kind of, and actually the first place he stayed was that YMCA on 23rd Street, which was, where his father dropped him off. Because it was one of the places, if you're going to SBA, it was on the list of places with the Chelsea Hotel, you know, that you could stay. And it wasn't too expensive. But Keith goes to Christopher Street, goes to the pier, meets somebody, goes home with them. And then, you know, within 48 hours, has managed to move himself out of the Y and into this little gay commune kind of on West 10th Street. And so that's the part, I mean, that I remember that time that was so great is how fast things happen and how these meetings happen and could change everything and how it was uncomfortable, but also nothing cost very much. So you would move your apartment every like 3 months or 6 months just to try a new neighborhood or because you're in a new relationship. And that kind of fluidity really mattered. And the inside outside, when he first meets Kenny Scharf, who we're talking about, the way they meet is Keith is doing a video of himself called Painting Myself into a Corner, where he paints himself into a corner on videotape with Devo soundtrack. Kenny Scharf.
So fucking gay.
Which you can see. So Kenny Scharf, you know, has come from California and is a little disappointed, you know, at the art school. Then he sees this and hears this and says, oh, that's why I came to New York, was to meet this guy. And they become roommates. But that first day, Kenny is making like a TV sculpture. And he gets Keith to come with him, like across town, and they find these TVs that people have put out for the garbage on the curb and kind of drag them with these ropes across town to make this sculpture. So it was all about art, all about fun. And, you know, both these guys were gay. And I mean, Kenny more bi at that moment. But, and, you know, the much fluidity was kind of going on. So it was, the place you want to be. And everybody knew it. I mean, at the time, I don't feel that it's one of those things where, like Steve Rubell said to me about Studio 54 once, people remember it better than it was. But in general, I don't think that was true. I think that we all kind of thought like, oh, this is great. You know? And people would come from around the world to go to these clubs and dance and go to Paradise Garage, which Keith loved and had the most amazing DJ. And, there was such a mix of people. So all that I think was true. And, you know, then the tragedy is that it gets cut in the middle with AIDS and becomes a different situation altogether. And now it's history. But it definitely, and the two work together. I mean, sexuality and identity for Keith and his painting and his art, I mean, they came together simultaneously. And that Keith, when he got to SBA and started drawing all these penises,
that was my next question.
The penis question. Yes. Right. What was your question?
So at the exhibit, so it's very interesting because you'll see mm-hmm. Radiant Baby or the dogs on, you know, tote bags that moms are carrying or water bottles or, you know, in this sort of way. So at the exhibit at the Broad, you know, it would be mm-hmm. a lot of, and you mentioned he had children come and stuff, but like, you know, it was a lot of families. And then there would be all these things that you know that you already know, And then you would go into the next room and it would be a massive penis drawing. Absolutely right. Huge statue of a penis. And I right. watched a couple parents go, okay, not in here, to their kid and move them away from that room. And to me, I mean, look, I'm not a parent, but to me, I was like, no, you don't get to choose. You want Keith Haring, you're going to get all of Keith Haring. Like, it's this very interesting thing of like what of his has become commercialized and what has become a little bit erased because it is political or it is, you know, sexy or whatever. I mean, he is, right. there's drawings of people fucking the dogs. Like, you know what I mean? Sure. And then people have those dogs like on their t-shirts. Like, it's very, how do you deal with like that sort of like, and how did he think of that dichotomy?
The fucked dog t-shirt. You...
They don't have it. They just have the lovely little dog and they conveniently forget the other one where right. the dog's getting right. fucked by the little guy.
I mean, there are a few aspects of that. One is, you know, he was like coming out at SVA by drawing all these penises. I mean, and he would do like things that had 1,000 of them in them and things, stuff like that. Or he had his like first assignment was to, you know, go do on a weekend a variation on something. And he did like all these penis drawings and penis in front of the Museum of Modern Art, penis on 12th Street. So that, that was very important in his coming out. I think he did though, he did think about those kids in a way because when he did really, like on the subways, like really public art, there was less penis drawing at that time. So he was aware. I mean, because he was doing all of these different, I mean, it wasn't like a prudish thing, but you know, he just had a sense of audience and things like that. He wasn't at all careful, but I think, you know, he had so much going on that the kid's side, wasn't like he didn't keep penis is totally out of it, but he liked playing around with both, you know, like the innocent baby, the innocent dog, and then all of a sudden you're right, the crawling figures are having sex and the dog and the boy are having sex right. and all that kind of stuff. Yeah, right. Which is, and that's really where it began. I mean, that's Keith coming out. That's what you kind of see in those figures, that moment around, you know, 1980, 1982, where he's just really coming out, and the source of his art and life is that kind of queer sensibility of his and his wanting to be open about it. But it was a funny generation. I mean, I think all for writers, for photographers like Robert Mapplethorpe, people were coming out in their work, but someone like Keith, you know, he never like, and he was completely open with his parents, but his mother told me he never said the word gay and he never said the word AIDS to her. So there's, you know, they're coming out of a kind of tight world and they're bringing it along with them, but there's still, you know, something that still has a hold on them, or they still are kind of aware of that. So that was, you know, it was a really interesting time of transition.
When did he start moving into like the AIDS activism aspect of the art?
Well, he'd always had sort of gay liberation activism. I mean, just as I was saying, drawing those penises and doing that kind of, that was gay art. And, you know, gay art was the kiss of death at that time. That was something else. And, I feel that a lot of the really vituperative criticism that comes towards Keith at that time from certain art critics is a kind of homophobia. So Robert Hughes at Time Magazine, who called him Keith Boring and called Basquiat, Jean-Michel Basquiat, Basquiat case. I mean, he had a really like fierce, and said that Basquiat was the Eddie Murphy of art, right? Which Keith pointed out was very racist.
What the fuck?
They weren't aware of it. Likewise, he said that Keith was a disco decorator. Those kind of things, like disco decorator, that's when they're getting at the gay thing. I mean, that there was unsaid often that you didn't have gay art in museums. You had gay artists. So artists of the pop era and Jasper Johns, Robert Rauschenberg, all the, but for your subject matter to be that open, you know, Keith never had a show at a museum in America during his lifetime. So he did struggle with that, I think. And part of it was definitely the gay thing. Part of it was definitely the hot mixing of high, low art. Mm-hmm. And commerce. So he started a pop shop. So he was the where he would sell t-shirts and buttons and cartoon books and all these things, you know, at price points that everyone could afford. This is when his work is now showing in galleries and is very expensive. It was kind of like you could get the same thing at the pop shop at, you know, 50 cents or the gallery for $50,000 or $5,000 at least. So, you know, it was an interesting situation and a new situation, and it definitely bothered some people. It was radical art in that way.
But then I saw at the museum a lot of work that he did for ACT UP. And so, like, yeah. I was just curious, like, when did he contract HIV, and when did he start getting, like, I imagine probably pretty soon after it made its way into his work.
Yeah, I mean, Keith always felt that he was probably HIV positive. His lover Juan DuBose died of AIDS, and that people around him and his lifestyle had been promiscuous and et cetera at a certain point. But at that point, and I remember this, we didn't take tests because there wasn't anything to do about it. I mean, there wasn't any. So if you didn't have symptoms, then why take a test? Eventually, you know, Keith in Tokyo discovers that he has like KS lesion, a red spot. And this is around 87, 88. And goes back to New York, and indeed then is diagnosed as having AIDS at that point. Before then, he'd been doing what everyone else does, which is see how your T cells are, what your count is, and if you're still healthy. And so at that point, I mean, everything that, you know, would have been simple gay liberation definitely becomes AIDS activism. And one of the first things he does is give a big interview for Rolling Stone, in which he comes out as a PWA, person with AIDS. This is very much not what was going on at the time. I mean, this is when Brock Hudson was dying of AIDS and refused to admit it. Roy Cohn, like from the grave, insisted that he had pneumonia. And, you know, obituaries of the time, everyone died of pneumonia suddenly. I mean, there's no mention of AIDS, rarely of long-term partners. All of this is kind of hidden away. The closet came back in that sense. And Keith definitely didn't do that. He goes to ACT UP. He's a big supporter of ACT UP. Peter Staley, who was the treasurer, told me that he used to go to Keith's studio and Keith would give him brown paper bags of cash, but like $10,000 in cash. And Peter would take them to the Citibank at LaGuardia Place. It's still there, and deposit his $10,000 in the ACT UP account. And he said in 1989, like a third of the receipts of ACT UP were paid for by Keith Haring. I mean, wow. He had a big impact. He did that great mural in the center where they met once upon a time. So but also during this time, he doesn't wither away. I mean, he instead really revs up his art production. I mean, he does more and more and more. And he travels to more and more and more places. So the most active period of a, you know, hyperactive life that he had in these 10 years is that last period where he's just really, and a lot of it is messaging. He does the Silence Equals Death paintings. He does posters. And so a lot of it is activism. I mean, a lot of it was also just great work. I mean, he was also doing these paintings that are among his best paintings. The last thing, big thing he does is this triptych altar, Last Judgment, which he does in Yoko Ono's apartment. And you can see it's a cathedral, St. John the Divine. It's in the cathedral in San Francisco and one in Paris. And it's a kind of religious work. I mean, with the cross, you know, with the radiant babies, now Jesus and going into heaven and all this kind of stuff, like, you know, great kind of imagination. He's only actually really, you know, he's in his studio until 3 weeks before he dies. And then he's at home. And the last things are like on his deathbed, he's drawing these radiant babies and on the last day, and he's frustrated because he can't really do it. And Kenny Scharf has, I think, is the last one of those drawings. So, but to, you know, just that he follows this line through all that. So the way that he dies is, and again, you know, I remember at that time with a lot of those guys, all of a sudden it was like, where did you get all this character? I mean, they had, you know, they had a kind of nobility about death and the, you know, a way of facing all this and funniness and still kind of sexuality, that there's all this kind of cruising going on in the halls of St. Vincent's Hospital. It was all, you know, all the whole sensibility was there kind of intact. And Keith is very inspiring that way, because he just, you know, he talked about it in the Rolling Stone interview. Everybody dies sometime. You know, there's always going to be an end. I could go on for 70 years. I still wouldn't say everything I wanted to say. And we're all in the chain link, you know, and carrying on from artists in the past to the future. He just had this, the kind of attitude that you sense often in the work and the activism and the community, you know, showed through as authentic in that last period.
He is quite young. I mean, whatever we're imagining, right? It's younger than that.
Well, he's 31 when he died. So everything was happening when he was like in his 20s. That's very amazing.
Yeah.
And also that he set up, at the end, he set up the Keith Haring Foundation. So he had the wherewithal to set up a foundation, put the directors in place, his family and friends, and then say that half the foundation should be giving away money to issues having to do with children and AIDS. And that's become the case. I mean, that foundation has given away over $30 million since his death to pediatrics AIDS foundations and just all of this stuff. So no one, again, no art star of the 80s was setting up a foundation that was charitable in that way and doing all this work in our time.
If you want to hear the rest of this episode, and let me tell you, you do, head over to patreon.com/justbetweenus. And for $3 a month, you can get access to all of our podcast episodes in full ad-free.
You can also get merch for this podcast at justbetweenuspod.com or allisonraskinexposed.com.
Okay, that's it. Tatala T2.
Tatala T2. Just between us.